I want to thank Abin Milinowitz and Arye Sonnenberg, who some of you know, who were actively involved in inviting me for Shabbos. Those of you who were with us, we really had a very beautiful Shabbos, and those of you who are here for the first time for the weekend, so it's a pleasure to at least have this opportunity, as we're about to go into the abbreviated week of Slichos, to share some thoughts of Tefillah together. For those of you who did hear me either this morning or this afternoon, unquestionably going to be some overlap and some repetition. You can't speak five times about tefillah in one Shabbos, in one shul, and not repeat yourself a little bit. But first of all, it's only going to be a little bit. And second of all, some really important things should be repeated. So we will try to do that. I know we started a little bit with Jewish time, but I was told that I should speak for an hour, pachot o yoter, so that you could set your schedule. That's what I hope to do. And I titled this year, Unleashing the Power of Tefillah. Because I think that we all have an instinct that there's something really powerful that tefillah can do. Can do for us, can do in our lives, can do for the world. But as we've been speaking throughout the Shabbos, for most of us, most of the time, it doesn't exactly go the way it's supposed to. It's not always a blank, but it seems to fall short of what it could be and should be. And we want it to be better. We want everything to be better, but especially our tefillah. We want that power to come out. So I was thinking, reminded actually, of a cute little story that I read about an atheist who was swimming in the ocean when before he knew it, there's a shark behind him. So he starts swimming really, really fast. But as fast as he's swimming, he turns around, the shark is gaining. And at some point, all of a sudden, the shark opens its mouth, and you have the big, shiny teeth. It's right there. This is the moment of truth. And our friend, the atheist, screams out, "Oh God! Save me!" And at that moment, the sun pierced through the clouds. Everything stops, including the shark, right in the moment with his mouth open. And a deep voice comes from the heavens. "But you don't believe in me." So our friend realizes this is not the time to start with excuses or explanations. And he just says, "You know, true. But how about the shark? Can't you make him believe in you?" So God responds, "As you wish." The light retracts. The clouds come back together. The waves start crashing. And all of a sudden he's swimming. And the shark's mouth is open. And all of a sudden he sees the shark's mouth starts to close. He can't believe it. And right when he's about to be completely converted and give his Hodu Lashem, he sees the shark bow his head and say, "Dear God, thank you for the food that I am about to eat." Now, why do I mention this? Because we know how powerful tefillah can be. But the problem is, if we don't really understand how to use it, not only do we miss an opportunity, but if we really mess up, we could end up davening for the wrong thing. We could cause damage, even. We say in the beginning of the Shemona Esrei, we refer to Hashem as a God, talk about Him as a Mogein, right? We talk about all these different synonyms about Hashem, and sometimes the Vilna Gaon speaks about. Sometimes we're asking for Hashem's help. Melchozer, Moshia, Umagain. So he says, sometimes we know what we're doing, but we all know we need a little Ashkacha Pratis. So we ask Hashem, "I'm going to work, I know what I need to do, but it should be an Ozer." Other times we say, "I have no clue. I'm at my wit's end, there's nothing. We need a Yeshua." That's Moshia. So what's Mugain? So the Vilna Gaon says, because sometimes we think we know what we're doing, and we're planning and planning, And really, it's counterproductive. We say, Hashem, magen, protect us from ourselves. So tefillah, it's a problem. I remember the last year we lived in Baltimore, we actually had a whole, around this time of year, we had a whole campaign for davening, and we actually used, it was ended up being citywide, and to bind everyone together, we all learned, the city, the book Praying with Fire. I became very friendly with the author, Heshi Kleiman, wonderful book. So for the Siyum at the end, the week before Rosh Hashanah, not only did the author come back to Baltimore in our shul, we had 800 people on a Tuesday night in Baltimore, but I wanted to bring the whole community together. We had two big speakers, Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky and my Rebbe, Rav Mordechai Willig. It was an amazing, amazing event. It was on the satellite network. People across America were watching it. I'll never forget, among the many wonderful things that Rabbi Willig said at that kenes, he said, with davening, once you have that power, then it's not just praying with fire, it's playing with fire. Right? Davening is that powerful. If you mess it up, there are stakes too. So we want to unleash the power of tefillah, but we want the blast radius to be in the right direction. We want the right things. So how do we do that? Now we know that davening is important. I don't know if we realize how important it is. The Tanhuma and Miketz says, Ein lecha gedola min atfila. It's the greatest. So what do you mean the greatest? You know, that's like an empty kind of a compliment or something. But the Gemara in Brachos says, Gedola mimaisim tovim. Even gadol me the karbanos. And the Gemara Megillah says, it's gadol me limud haTorah. So anything you think is super important. There's a Maimer Chazal somewhere that says that davening is even more important. And yet, the Gemara also says, we alluded to it over Shabbos, that davening, Gemara Brachos, a very famous Gemara, that davening is one of those things that's omdim berumo shalolam, and yet, adim bezalzalin ba. It's the most important thing, and we step all over it. We don't take it seriously. We don't use it. So why? Could it be that we don't need anything? Are our lives so perfect that we don't need davening? And maybe your life is so perfect, but is the Jewish people's situation so perfect? So how could it be that every chance we get, we're not davening the most amazing tefillah? You don't need anything? And the answer is, I think, because we're human. Davening is hard. So it's true, the Ramban says, the davening is mimidas hachesed. Right? Imagine if the King of Kings, or even for that matter, the Prime Minister, gave you a card with his private number. Said, whenever you call, I'll answer. Now, I can't promise you, you're always going to get the answer you want. But here's the private number. Could you imagine, like what, who wouldn't take advantage of that? So that's what the Ramban says. Tila is mimidas hachesed. Hashem says, call me, I'll answer. But it's hard. It's hard. And it's circular. This is why the problem is so vexing. I've been doing a lot of thinking about this. A number of the Mefarshim speak about how if you don't have Kavana, so then Kavana, let me take a step back. Many of you have heard, if not in seminary, then subsequent, the idea, what's the famous phrase about Kavana? The Tvila Bli Kavana, Keguf Lo Neshama. I once ran into a woman who was traumatized for 20 years because of the way she was taught that with such negativity. She made her feel so bad about herself. So leave aside the misapplication or the misuse of that teaching. But it's a very powerful teaching. It's found in the Chovos HaLevavos, the Shloha HaKodosh, others. The tefillah without kavana, it's like a guf, it's like a body without a neshama. So I saw just this week in preparation for my visit here, a Sefer on Chumash, the Ponim Yafos, on Parshas Ve'aschanan, on Moshe davening 500 plus tilos to be allowed to do what we're all doing, living in Eretz Yisrael, and he didn't get the answer he wanted. So the Ponim Yafos, he uses this metaphor, he takes it very literally. He says, davening without kavana, it's like dead weight. It's heavy. When you shake the lulav, even if you don't have the most kavana, it's not like a hard or bad experience. But davening seems to be like almost all or nothing for people, which is a shame, which we'll speak about. But people who really daven great, so they love it, and it comes, they do it. But the alternative seems to be so difficult. And he says, that's why. Because davening without the kavana, it's like dead weight. That's very heavy to carry that around. On the other hand, if it's alive, We have a principle from Hilchos Shabbos. You know this if you had little kids and you weren't sure if there was an Erev and could you carry the little child or not. And what's the halacha? If the child can walk his or herself, the Gemara says, Chai no se atzmo. Even if you're carrying somebody, but who could be walking? So that's what the Panim Yafa says, is if you have a tefillah with kavana, a guf with an neshama, it carries itself. Davening with kavana is like the lightest thing. It, mamash, like people, the davening carries you. And many of us, maybe all of us, but certainly many of us, I think, have had tefillos like that. Yamim Narayim in a beautiful shul, maybe at Kever Rachel, happens to be a special place for a lot of people. Less people daven well at the Kotel, but some people even daven well there. Nebuch, if you have a tzara. We've had our moments. We've seen what it looks like on the other side. And that's why it's so frustrating that so often it's just heavy. So if we have the kavana, it'll be great. But if we don't have the kavana, since we don't have the kavana, so how do we get the kavana? I don't have the answer, and I don't think there is only one answer. But I'd like to share with you in the time that we have a few answers, or put it this way, a few of the problems of why we don't have kavana, and because of that, some of the solutions, which are not one size fits all, and we probably all need to use all of them at some point in our lives. So first of all, I think there are some practical problems. We're familiar with the term hachana. I don't mean from Hilchos Shabbos, but preparation. Preparation for life, for mitzvos. So some of you may be familiar with, the Mishnah even speaks about the Hasidim Harishonim. Right? They prepared for davening. How long? Mar says an hour. So when I speak about or mention the idea of preparing for davening, I think implicitly, psychologically, most people imagine that that's something for like really frum people. Like Hasidim with a capital Ches. But that's not me, and that's not what, like, that's not the mitzvah. It's davening, and if I'm really, really special, you know, I'm not even discussing now the practical issues of the thousand things in my life going on, and if I could just find 10 minutes to daven, wouldn't that be amazing? So where's the preparation coming from? But I'm speaking now even in principle, al pi hashkafa. But it's a terrible mistake. It's a terrible mistake. And actually, in a very beautiful sefer, which if you can read it, I highly recommend, in the sefer Sha'arim B'Tfila, so Rav Pinkus points out a kind of a two-part, very brilliant insight from the Rambam why this is such a terrible mistake. Because we think of hachana, preparing, as something extra. But if you look carefully, the Rambam says that there are five things which are ma'akev, the davening. If you don't have those five, it's really it's as if you didn't daven, it's nothing. The fifth of those five is kavana, davening without kavana. And in that halacha, where the Rambam's saying that you need to have kavana, without kavana, it's nothing, the Rambam mentions preparing before davening. Hachana. In other words, far from being some extra thing which maybe if we're chassidish, again, there I mean the lowercase chas, for a chassidim, that somehow extra will go for it. On the contrary, it's just the opposite. But at least it seems from the Rambam that it's impossible to have kavana if you haven't prepared. And if you haven't prepared, you won't have kavana. You won't really have a davening. Now, why is that? If that's true, then why is it? And I think the reason is, for those of you who were in Shul Friday night, Rabbi Malinowitz alluded to this, and I've mentioned it more than once over the weekend, is because what's the biggest challenge of davening, I think? It's not the Parish Hamilim. Those are all, those type of books and stuff, those are band-aids. They're important, but they're not the real key. The ikar is the idea of being omei lifnei Hashem. To actually have an awareness, which Rabbi Malinowitz very bravely spoke about how hard this is for him. So if it's hard for him, we can admit that it's hard for us too. To really feel like Hashem is right there and we're talking to Him. Without a physical focal point, it's difficult. So what does Hachana do? Hachana is what helps with that. Now, again, I know how crazy my life is, and how busy I am. I know that I have to, you know, double or triple that for my wife. So I know that for many of you, as I say, I'm not being patronizing, and I'm certainly not being dismissive. I know how hard it is just to find the time. But my first recommendation is to, and again, if you have a shiloh of like exactly how to divide the time, you should ask your rav. That's a really important practical question. But at least speaking in principle now, we should always try to find more time. So if we have the time to have a few minutes before we daven, to start, just think, what do I need? What's going on in my life? What's going on in the world, the Jewish people? What's important? Then start davening. And if you can't add the extra 5 minutes, I would say, again, ask a shayla, but to me, it's at least conceivable, better to give away some of the time of the davening, but to spend a few minutes beforehand with the hachana. There's an old proverb or parable about the person who has to cut the logs, the woodcutter, and he's cutting and he's cutting, and after hours and hours, you know, he's only done a few logs. So somebody says to him, you know, you should sharpen the saw, it's become dull after all that time. He says, but I don't have time because I have to cut all the wood. Doesn't realize, of course, that if he'll take an hour off from cutting the wood to sharpen the saw, he'll get far more done in the less time that he has. Davening after spending a few minutes in Hachana is a completely different experience and far more superior than more time spent in getting more of Psukei to Zimra in, etc., without the Hachana. So that's my first suggestion. Acknowledge how difficult this is. And again, Hachana doesn't mean that the first time you do this, it's all going to be great. But spend some time. It's hard. And it takes effort. It's avoda. Shebelev, it's hard work. So one of the ways to do that, to help confront that, I think, is to spend a little bit of time, even if it's only a minute, but it's worth it. It'll help. Second point, which was for those of you who are here, was the main focus of the afternoon lecture before Mincha. The second reason davening is so hard for all of us is, of course, the issue of repetition and rote. And I'm not going to repeat the whole afternoon shiur where we spoke about all of the benefits and the milas of having a fixed sitter and a text, despite the challenges that that provides. But I do want to focus now on what I did at the end of that shiur, which is talk about the flip side, which is despite the fact that Chazal clearly, in their immense wisdom, prepared a sitter for us and a Shmon Esrei and a fixed text, which we repeat, and with all the challenges of the repetition that comes, Chazal understood, and in many places in Halacha and Hashkafa speak about, the importance of breaking through that and figuring out ways to be mechadesh and give newness to your tefillah. If you never do anything different, and you're always saying the same tefillah over and over, and you always have the exact same brachos, baruch shemar, ashrei, yishtaba, you know, the same thing that they gave you on the card in seminary, and you do the exact things. So you're, first of all, you're ahead of so many other people who don't do that. That's amazing. Ashreichem. But you shouldn't be surprised that at some point in your life, it lost the fire. No one can keep that up forever, endlessly, with the same passion. It's impossible. So what are you supposed to do? The answer is you have to find ways to change things up. So first, little suggestions. I think I may have alluded to this in the afternoon, but I can't remember in one of the Sfarim, I think it may be from one of my Kleinman Sfarim, he mentions this. I think it's a fantastic little thing, but it's not a Kleinigkeit, it's real. He mentions Rav Shmuel Kamenetsky said, every now and then, change your sitter. Something as little as that. Still the same words, but just do that little thing differently. You had that sitter that you love. I'm attached to my sitter too. But every now and then. And if you really can't give that up, so then change for a month. Then go back to it. But that little thing, in a similar way, this would perhaps be a little bit more relevant to an audience of men, but how it applies to you, for women as well. So Rav Dessler speaks about it. He quotes, I think, from Ruchum Lubavitz. He says, change your makom, change your place. So if you have a makom kavua in shul, again, the Rambam, the Gemara, talks about how important makom kavua is. Sev mechtam elio. Every few years, change that makom. And if you daven at home, so many of us daven in the same place at home, change that every now and then. But just that change in circumstance, again, it seems like a little thing. I can already see a lot of you are thinking, come on, this is a little thing, it's childish. It is little, but it's not childish. It'll make a difference. Just change things up. It'll help you focus. It'll remind you there's something new today than there wasn't yesterday. And of course, in this vein, the most important thing you can do is actually change your davening. By which I mean to say, you can add things to your davening. And this comes in two forms. First of all, as I mentioned this in the shiur this afternoon, there's some source sheets floating around, you can even see it in print if you'd like, the great, great Gaon and Tzaddik, Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz. So, you may, not all of you may realize it, but a lot of stuff that doesn't happen in your kitchen is because of him. He was one of the most brilliant halachists who spoke about Yoredeya and the laws of Kashrus. But he also has a sefer called Ya'aros Dvash, which is two volumes, the way they publish it now, of drushos that he gave. Brilliant drushos. Much longer even than Rabbi Milinowitz's. Am I right? Really long drushos. Sometimes you see these old... The Ramban has a drusha on Rosh Hashanah. I don't know when they blew the shofar. They must have been in shul for hours listening. You never know. The way they... You know, they used to have more patience. I remember a few years ago, I was with my wife and my parents. And we were in Italy. We went to the great synagogue in Rome. If you've ever been there, it's an amazing shul to see. But they have a museum from some of the old things. And I remember my father shows me that they have a thing where they used to, you know, to give out the liyas. Some shuls still do this, where they'll go over to people, they give a little card. This is in silver. Kohen, Levi. And then it also had for Asafos. It had 24 cards. But, you know, there's no shul you could get away with that anywhere. So people used to have more patience for the davening, for the laning, for the drushos. So the Yaros Dvash of Yonasan Eibshitz in one of his drushos, he makes a point which is obvious once he says it, but he's one of, I don't know if he's the first, but he's one of the first to say it. And he points out that all of the things that, which sources before him mention about how a person is allowed to add personal bakashos, and it's not just as we were taught in elementary school after Elokai Mitzor, it's not just after, like we learned in high school, that in Shema Koleinu, but it says black on white in Shulchan Aruch, in every single bracha in the middle of the Shemona Esrei, a person is allowed to add their own personal bakashos. Now, exactly how you do it, in which language, and for yourself, or in Lashon Ra. So that, there's halachos about it, there are books that are written about it, if you have Rabbanim, you can ask, but it's explicit in Shulchan Aruch, you should do that. Certainly you can do that. So Rabbi Yonasan Eibshitz just makes the obvious point. He says, why did Chazal mention this? Why did this come about? So he says explicitly, because that's what will help break the rote and the monotony. Sometimes we don't do it because we can't think of anything in particular that we really need. Or we feel like, who am I to ask? But it says, you're making a mistake. If you're not doing it for your own, quote-unquote, selfish needs, then do it for your spiritual needs. It will change your Shemona Esrei completely. Add things. And if you have nothing to ask for, just give me a call. I have plenty. And I don't mind if you daven for me. And I know other people who wouldn't mind. There's so much we could ask for, so much we need individually, as a community, as a nation, as a country. It'll change your Shemona Esrei. And there's a last point, or last in this overall point, and that is you shouldn't think that talking to Hashem and improving that is limited to davening or limited to Shemona Esrei. I found this idea in a number of sources, but just this week, actually, I found it at least four different places in the works of Rav Chaim Friedlander, of the Sifsei Chaim. And he points out how important it is to talk to Hashem in our own language, with our own words, outside of shul, outside of the framework of davening. Just talk to Hashem whenever we need something. Now, that we are allowed to do it, lots of people say that, although we don't always take advantage of it. And I have to say, I don't do enough of this myself. But every now and then, and I guess we all understand why, certainly since I've come to Eretz Yisrael, there seem to have been more needs. So I've definitely done it more in recent years than I had ever done beforehand. But I have different experiences. An important phone call, an important meeting, life cycle event, we made a bar mitzvah and a bas mitzvah since we came here, where before a certain event, I'll just stop and say, please Hashem, help me. I happened to be at the Kotel on Friday morning, Hanachas Tefillin of my nephew, and we went, you know, afterwards, you know, they snapped the pictures, and then I went up to the Kotel. So I didn't say Tehillim, but in my own words, I said to Hashem, I have a big weekend coming up. It's a really important shul. The Rav is a big Talmid Chacham and he has high standards. It's a learned community. Help me be successful. Help me be Mezakeh, this Tzibur, a few days before Rosh Hashanah. Now, why is that so important? Before a meeting, a job interview, God forbid, a medical, whatever the situation is. So this is the insight of Chaim Friedlander, which is so powerful. He says, not only does that help our Midah of Bitachon, the idea of living with Hashem throughout our day and our lives, which that's more obvious, but he says, once we get comfortable and familiar talking to Hashem in an informal way throughout the day, that will also energize and transform the Shmona Esrei. Even if we're not adding the Bakashos, just saying the words Rafa'enu, but the more I habituate myself, the more I train myself to talk to Hashem, as we spoke about for those of you here this morning, having a conversation with Hashem. So again, I don't want to repeat the whole drasha, but in 1 minute, the drasha this morning was all about how life, our Avodas Hashem, it's all about one thing and one thing only, having a relationship with Hashem. And we know the key to any meaningful relationship is communication. That's tefillah. So the more we talk to Hashem in a way that is very real, Karav Hashem l'chol karav asher yikru'uhu be'emes. If you don't feel close to Hashem in your davening, this is not a criticism, it's just a fact, it's probably because it's not be'emes. We have to keep it real. So we can do that even within the confines of the Siddur. We could add bakashos, as I mentioned, but says Reb Chaim Friedlander, even if you're not adding bakashos, the more you've trained yourself to think and talk in terms of a conversation with Hashem, even the little things, you know, it's 3:15, the kids are coming home, please Hashem, keep it calm. You know, please Hashem, make dinner good. Please Hashem, let me have nachas from so and so. Please Hashem, little things. The more we create that relationship of communication in our lives in general, then when we then open up that same fixed text, the text that Jews have been saying for thousands of years, that you've said thousands of times, that will be different because you've learned how to talk to Hashem. It won't be dry. It'll be alive. It'll be real. It'll be be'emes. And then we will feel karov. I think there's some other factors as well. That's our second point. We had the issue of preparation, we had the issue of rote, and different strategies of how to get escape from that. I think on a deeper level, you could say, perhaps, there are some philosophical, hashkafic ideas where I think perhaps we live under mistaken impressions or illusions, and that leads to a number of problems, including having difficulty with tefillah, which I think if we could really dig deep and uproot those, I think as a byproduct, memela, the davening will improve. So one of those is that, not necessarily consciously, but for most of us, we live under an illusion of independence. We don't really think about how dependent we are on Hashem. And on a related point, I think many of us confuse the idea of hishtadlus and dependency. Let me explain. We know that a central part of our davening, certainly on a weekday Shemon Esrei, is bakasha. Gimme, 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 gimme. So, if you think about that, why is that so important? If a person davens without that, if all they do is praise Hashem and thank Hashem, their yod say nothing. A central ingredient, indispensable, it is ma'akev, is bakasha. Why? Again, we seem like we're like that kid in F.A.O. Schwartz, you know, with they won the thing from the radio station, a credit card has $1,000 on it, you can get anything you want. You know, give it. So unbecoming. That should be so important. I mean, it's a chiddush that we're allowed to ask. Okay, thank you. But why? If the halacha says it's required, what if I don't need anything? The answer, once we think about it, I think is obvious and incredibly powerful. And that is that the purpose of all the asking is to remind us who can do the answering. We don't ask for things from people who can't affect the situation. Right? When my son wants to go out for pizza with his friends, so he knows to ask me for the money and not his teacher. But after he's done a test and he's worried about how he's going to do and he needs maybe the teacher to be a little lighter on the grading, he doesn't ask me for that. He asks the teacher. You know, kids get very smart very quick on that point. They know who can help and what, and they know who to ask. Right? The really smart ones know what to ask mommy for, what to ask Abba for. Right? So we don't like being played like that. But from their perspective, it makes all the sense in the world. We ask for things from the one, from the person, who can make the difference, who can help. So if every day, for our most basic needs, we're asking Hashem for our health, for our parnasa, for everything, what are we hopefully getting the message? It's that He's the one who can give them to us. We are dependent on Him for all of those things. As important as Hishtadlos is, and it is incredibly important, we shouldn't confuse Hishtadlos, which is a way to get it, and Bitachon, which is the address from who we're getting it. For all of the Hishtadlos, we have to remember, it's still going to come from Him, or not. But in the end, the only way to get it, the way Hashem made the world, is with Hishtadlos, and as many Sfarim point out, Tefillah is a part of Hishtadlos. Bitachon is sitting there doing nothing, hoping. Anything that we can do that will affect the outcome is called Hishtadlos. Davening is one of those things. So we shouldn't be confused, on the contrary. We're not as independent as we'd like to think. We do need Him. Every now and then we have a real challenge in life that reminds us. But hopefully we don't have those challenges if we just remember even without that. And one of the ways we're supposed to remind ourselves, again, it's subliminal. But it's not systematic, but the work of Hashkafa from Chazal, I'm not talking about after Chazal, the work of Hashkafa from Chazal is the sitter. It's the sitter. And one of the things the sitter is teaching us is that Hashkafa of Bitachon, of dependence. What's important in life? What should we be asking for? And why are we asking? Because this is where it comes from. This is the address. So that mindset, I think, can also, if we shift it, will also, in a very powerful way, help with our davening. And one little other point. The Shulchan Aruch talks about how when we daven with kavana, we should daven as if we're a poor person turning to someone to help us. So I think, if I'm not mistaken, this may have been in the Sharim B'Tfilah, another insight, which is relevant and related. It says, if you look in the halachos of Hilchos Tzedakah, there are two types of aniyim, and therefore two types of responses and responsibilities we have. One type of poor person is someone who's knocking on all the doors. So you're supposed to give them something, but you're not achrai to take care of all their needs, because you know they're going to go to 100 other people. But then there are other aniyim, for whom you're the only address. They are, right? Children being the most obvious example. The Gemara talks about somech al shochan of you. But even if it's not it could be that not a family member. But if there's certain rare circumstances, the Shulchan Aruch says, where the Rambam says, someone's reliant on you. And there the halacha is completely different. There, as much as you can afford, at least, but your responsibility, at least theoretically, is to give that person everything they need. Because they only have the one address. It's either what they get from you and nobody else. So Cesar Pincus, we have to realize, when the Shulchan Aruch says we're like a poor person asking, that's the problem. Some of us think that we have lots of addresses, and Hashem is one of them. The doctor's one, the lawyer is one, this one is one, my parents are another one, my boss is a third one, and I'm very frum. I know that Hashem is one too. So then, we have a mimuna, Hashem will give us. But Hashem doesn't have to give us everything we want, because after all, we're like that ani who has many addresses, he's going to knock on many doors. So he'll give us the pruta. He'll give us the shekel. But if we realize that that's a mistake, that really we only have one address, and that's Hashem. What do you mean we only have one address? I go to work, I do all those things. Yeah, but they're not an address. They're a mechanism. But the ultimate success is only from one place. is Hashem. And we say, we are somech, avinu shebashamayim. We are somech on your shulchan. So then we have a much greater opportunity to get all of the brachos that we want. So it's a shift in thinking. But if we can internalize it, I think it could really help our davening. Another hashkafa, philosophical point, I think, which is an illusion, and it hurts our davening. That is that because so many of us struggle, at least now and then, that we think there's no point. We give up. It's the second, it's the third bracha, I'm already spacing out, I'm already thinking about all the things I have to do. So what's the point in kind of getting back on the horse? Yesterday's davening wasn't so great, the day before the davening wasn't great, the day before I forgot to daven, and we kind of give up on it. And it's a big mistake. This is a bigger halachic topic, but I'll just mention very briefly, because there's a number of sources. Half a loaf is better than none. That's number one. Kaf HaChaim, a great Sephardi posuk, says, you hadn't had kavana? Okay, so for the rest of the Shemana Tisrei, have kavana. It's not an either or. But moreover, it's more than that. It's deeper than that. I saw in one of the halachas farm a beautiful idea. The Gemara says in one place that davening is even greater than karbanos. What does that mean? So this particular sefer explained, because a karban, when the kohen has the wrong or is lacking kavana, that karban is completely disqualified as pasul. But based on a pasuk, he darshins that a tefillah, even if it had no kavana, it's not disqualified, it's not thrown away. He says it's munach bekeren zavut, it's held over in the corner. And then whenever it is the next time you have a tefillah with kavana, then that gets back added on, and you get, it's like if you went, from the old days when you had to know how to score the bowl, right? After you carry the strike, and then you get double points, and now you don't have to think anymore, it's on the computer. But that's what he says. He says, and again, for some of us, we got a lot of chips piling up. You know, there's 70 straight tefillos without kavana. They're one a waste. They're all in the corner. When you have that one tefillah with kavana, he says, then it re-energizes and brings all those other tefillahs back. And they get added in. Amazing. Amazing chiddush. So don't give up. Don't give up on davening. Even if it's hard for you. Even if you had a bad day, a bad week, or a bad decade. Don't give up. Now, up to my last 2 points. Why is it that we often give up? Why is it... So I think these last 2 points, if I had to say, I think these are really the biggest. And if we could work on these, I think they would really change everything. So I'll tell you a true story, and there's at least one woman in the room who knows the shul I'm referring to, although I hope not the people exactly. But one of my biggest frustrations when I was a young rabbi, like any rabbi, there was a certain amount of talking in the shul, and that frustrated me. It was a very interesting phenomenon because we had a very heterogeneous shul, and there were people with very little background and people who had spent many years in learning at various different kinds of yeshivas. And for the most part, the median was a pretty high level, including the davening, I thought. But we had some people, a minority, we had some people who had, they were davening challenged. And when you're davening challenged, again, I can at least speak for the men's section, often there's talking. So in that chevra, there were people who had really no background. And even though I was upset that they were talking and they were disturbing people, but in my heart of hearts, Hashem could be made, I wasn't upset at them. Because I knew that they didn't know any better. But there was a tzibur, who were all yeshiva guys, and they dressed, you know, they only dressed a certain way and all that stuff. And they spent the whole davening talking. In the back, the Kriyas HaTorah, Chazar HaShas, talking. And if I even looked at them, it was like, who am I? A chutzpah. And it really just grated on me. It was wearing me down. And it was like the second or the third year I came over living in Baltimore. It was in the summer when I got invited to a different congregant's house who was having a parlor meeting. He was hosting it for Lakewood, the yeshiva. And they brought in, as they did every few years, Rav Matisyahu Solomon, the famous mashkiach. So before the people came to hear him to hopefully then give the money, they invited the Rabbanim for dinner with the Mashkiach. And afterwards, he moved into the owner of the house's study, and the Rabbanim were each given like a few minutes to speak to him. So there was a small number of the Rabbanim who actually had learned in Lakewood, and so they had spent more time with him. Most of the Rabbanim in the city had not learned in Lakewood, but still, you know, who wouldn't want to have an opportunity to have a few minutes to speak to him? So when I got there, I was like the youngest rabbi in the city by far, so I was like the last in line, and I went. And by that point, he's exhausted. He had traveled. He had a big thing coming up. So he was kind of looking down a little bit. And I sat and I was introduced to him and told him, new rabbi, all those good things. So I said, Mashgiach, if I could just ask your chizuk for something. There's something that's really been difficult in the Rabbanus. And I told him exactly this point. I said, I have people in the shul, yeshiva life, people who should know better. And they're talking and it's driving me crazy. I don't know what to do. I'm going to tell them what it says in Shulchan Aruch. They know already. I'm going to tell them, you know, go read such and such a book. They read it already. They heard it all already. They were tuned out years ago in yeshiva. So what am I going to tell them new? I couldn't understand. Why is it happening? So he looked up at me and says, that's easy. They don't believe in davening. And then he put his head back down. And it took me like hours and then days and weeks. I don't know. What did he mean? Really? From people? Guys spent years in yeshiva and in kol, they don't believe in davening? And then I realized, of course, he's right. And it's not just them. There are lots of us who don't really believe in davening. And then it clicked when sometime later I saw it from one of his svarim. He quoted the following idea from his Rebbe of Elia Lapian. There's the Gemara in Maseches Rosh Hashanah that speaks about, very appropriate for this time of year, two people, one both on the deathbed, or alternatively, two people in the hangman's noose, exactly the same situation, all things being equal, both mamash about to die. One person was saved and one person wasn't saved. So the Gemara says, what was the difference? So this one davened and this one didn't. Really? Someone's the hangman's noose, they didn't daven? So the Gemara says, well, okay, fine, they both davened, but this one davened a tefillah shalema, and this one didn't daven a tefillah shalema. Now, what does that mean? I mean, you all know what the words mean, but what does it mean? So Rashi adds one word, niskaven, had kavana. Does that make any sense to you? You'll tell me on a Wednesday morning in November, you davened once without kavana. Nope. It's believable, right? But someone on their deathbed, someone with the hangman's noose around their neck, and they're having trouble not having their mind wander to the sports pages or whatever while they're davening, they're already thinking, really? I mean, we'd like to think, you know, at least then we'd have kavana, right? Could it be that someone davened on their deathbed but without kavana? So Rav Matis Yael Salomon, he quoted this from Rav Elia Lapian, he says, no, that's not the shot. What does it mean, kavana? He says, there's two types of kavana. He says, sometimes people are davening with such enthusiasm, but it's out of a matzav of yayish. They're davening with tears, because they're already imagining and accepting the horrible outcome that they're now mourning. I remember we had some people in the community that were sick at various points, and we'd have these Tehillim rallies that many communities sometimes have, and you'd see people, mamish, they're davening. But you could see it on their eyes. You know why they were davening with such kavana? Because they're already imagining how sad it will be for the widow and her young children. They're already imagining how bad it's going to be for the parents when that child passes away. That's what they're davening for, because the parent just got the diagnosis. Cesar Matias El Sassar, Rav Elia Lapian, excuse me, that's a tefillah she'ena shlema. We daven with kavana, that means that it could work. Of course we don't know what Hashem's going to decide. But we have to daven from a position of confidence, of optimism. We have to daven that it should work, and we have to believe that it can work. When we're davening, when it's already that we gave up, it's already fafalin, that's not a davening. And that's certainly not a kavana. Again, it relates also to this time of year. We know from the Haftorah, we're going to read about with Hagar and Ishmael. Right? So you know the story. And Hagar's davening, and she davens to Hashem, you shouldn't let me see the death of this child. And then, eventually it says that Hashem answered and saved the child, but Mefarshim are Medayek. So why did Hashem save Yishmael? And think about the consequences of this for all of us. Why did Hashem save Yishmael? So the Medayek, it wasn't because of Hagar's tefillahs, it was because of Yishmael's. So how come? So a number of Sfarim, they all make the same point. It's Medayek, it's Meduyek in the Chumash even. When she was crying, he was already dead. She was davening a tefillah already of giving up, of yish. He was a child, it was his own survival, he was davening, God save me. When we daven without a belief in davening, so then it's heavy, then it's dead, it's lifeless, and then it's not really going to work. We have to believe in davening. It affects so many things, how we relate to davening. We continue the conversation, sort of Matisel Sam. I think they were trying to wonder what's the young guy still doing in there. But he told me something amazing. A lot of shuls have a mishaberach, I think the shul here does also, for people who don't talk during shul. So I don't know if this is exactly the one they did here, or not too many shuls, but there's a famous one that goes back to the author of the Tosfos Yom Tov, the famous mishaberach of the Tosfos Yom Tov, which he wrote during the Chmelnytsky massacres, the Gzeros Tach V'tat. He thought in his mind somehow that that was the avera that caused these terrible things. So Rabbi Matisyahu Solomon asked the question, really, could it be? That makes sense to you? Again, it's not a good thing to talk in davening, for sure not. Not for men, not for women, not for children. You shouldn't talk in davening. But that would bring such horrible destruction? The Chmelnytsky massacres, communities wiped out, cruelty? The Shulchan Aruch says, the one avera in the whole Shulchan Aruch where the Gemara says, it's too great, gadol avoni minaso, the lashon of the Gemara, of the Shulchan Aruch. Not about eating on Yom Kippur, not about illicit sexual relations, not about Chil Shabbos, not about treif. The one avera in the whole Shulchan Aruch is what? Talking during Chazaras HaShatz. So again, really, that's so bad? What's pshat? Chmelnytsky massacres? So he said, unbelievable chiddush, based on this idea from Rav Elia Lapian. Do we believe in davening or not? This is no question in the Chmelnytsky massacres, and you could apply it to every contemporary situation we have as a community. They had Tehillim rallies, and people came and special davening, and they davened with such kavana, and they couldn't understand why aren't we being answered. This is pshat is not they weren't talking then. Then you could hear a pin drop. But what were they doing in their davening before that? The weeks, the months, and years before that. If you talked in Ramazazel in the davening before you needed it, what does that show? That you don't really believe in it. You don't really believe in the davening. So except now it's convenient. You need it. You want to pull it out of your back pocket. That doesn't work. Nebuch, that's what the Shulchan Aruch, God of, someone who talks during davening, Shulchan Aruch says you have no hope. Because who could survive without tefillah? And once you're mezalzel in the davening, then even when you'll then summon the courage and summon the conviction to daven well, but you already showed you don't really take it seriously. It's just convenient. You're like our atheist. You need it when you need it, and when you don't need it, you don't need it. So the basic mistake we make is we don't understand what it means to believe in davening, and therefore we don't really believe in davening. And once we don't believe in it, we can't appreciate it. And then, even if we'll daven well, it's probably not going to be answered, and we probably won't daven well. So my second to last point is, we have to work, again, I'm leaving, I don't have a million hours, that's not an exaggeration, by the way, I probably would need a million hours, together with us, to work on, what does that mean, and how do we, mechazek our amunah. I'm leaving that for you. But at least know what you need to do. We need to work on our amunah, and not just in general, our amunah in davening. If we'll strengthen that, that's like sharpening the saw. Mamela, you'll see, I promise you, the davening will itself be better. You have to really believe in it. Work on that. I think it's a very important point. And last but not least, not at all least, I saw an idea also just recently, which I had been thinking of it in my own way probably for years. But I never put it into words exactly like this, and even if I did, I'm just me. But I saw from two of the great, and a lot of the Sfarim they speak about of the last 100 plus years, the two great Kohanim, the Kohen of Lublin, Rab Tzadok HaKohen, and certainly in Eretz Yisrael we speak about Rab Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Cook, the two great Kohanim Gedolim, great deep Baal Machshava, very a lot of similarities between their thoughts. And I saw an idea that Rav Cook writes in his Oros HaTshuva, which is one of the most incredible works ever written about Tshuva. And that Rav Tzadok HaKohen, the famous Rav Tzadok, writes in one of his Sfarim called Tzidkas HaTzadik. And they both make the exact same idea in general and specifically when it comes to davening. Where Rav Cook writes says, how come we don't really daven well? Not because of a chisaron in belief in bitachon, in Hashem, but because we lack a belief in ourselves. And Rabbi Tzadok HaKohen says the exact same thing. Kishem shetzarech adam lahamin b'Hashem yizbarach, kach tzarech acharkach lahamin b'atzmo. How does that relate to davening? This is not just some self-help book or some workshop to make you feel good. What does that mean? So what I think it means is, and they explain it, but I'm giving you the in between the lines. Many of us have a problem. We don't daven the way we should because we don't feel worthy. Who am I to talk to Hashem, the Melech Malchei HaMelechim? Who am I to ask for this? And he has so much on his mind, my little Pekala. Who am I? But it's a huge mistake. You know who you are? You're a Chelek Eloka Mimal. You have a piece of Hashem in you. You're a Jew. You're unbelievably special. As the Ramban said, I mentioned at the outset, Hashem gave you his private number. You have every right to ask for whatever you need. But I think, just as some people have a hard time believing in Hashem, again, the Tzaddik said it, there's so many of us who have a hard time believing in ourselves. Because who knows better than us all of our imperfections? Not even our spouse, not even our children. Certain things we've hid even from them. So we know how unworthy we are. We know how much work we need to do in the Yom Narayim. But it's not a contradiction, it's not a stira. With that, Chayiv Adam Lahamin Ba'atzmo, you are worthy of Hashem's Hashkacha. And when we don't have that belief, it affects us in many ways, but it really affects our davening. I'm reminded of a different, but a very related pshat by the Kedushas Levi, Rav Levi Yitzchak Berditchev. He points out that we know we're going to get to in a few weeks after Rosh Hashanah and Sukkot, everyone piles on Noach. Well, I know he wasn't as good as Avraham. Why not? So one of the classical answers is, it's actually based on the Zohar, that as opposed to Avram who davened to fight for the survival of Sodom, Noah just listened to everything Hashem said, but oh, you want to destroy the world, no problem, I'll build my teva, I'll do everything you want. He didn't fight over it. You see that in a number of Sfarim. So Akadushas Halevi, so why didn't he fight over it? So the simple pshat, you see, and you see this in some Sfarim explicitly, is they say that he was too inward focused, he was too selfish, he didn't care about other people. But the Kedushas Halevi can't even imagine that. I believe Yitzchak. So he says, what's the pshat? Why didn't he fight? So this is what he says, unbelievable. He says, because Noach doubted his own worthiness. When he found out that he was going to be saved and the whole world was going to be destroyed, Noach didn't think he deserved it. And there's a fine line between humility and insecurity, and he was way over the line. So what happened? It started off at the beginning of the process, he didn't think he was worthy of being saved. Excuse me, didn't think he's worthy of fighting. And it snowballed. So by the time the waters come, what is the Torah says it, and Rashi makes the point, he didn't get in the teva until the waters were up to his neck. Rashi says, Maimin ve'eno mamin. Noach was not a maimin. He didn't really believe in the flood. It's in Rashi. Many of you have seen this Rashi. So says Gishalevi, no, he didn't believe in himself. What's one necessary ingredient you would have to have to argue with Hashem when Hashem told you his plans? Right, what's one thing for sure you need? A lot of self-confidence. To go toe-to-toe, or Banish Shalom, Hatzadig, this is what the Shofet, the Tzadik, and the Yasa Mishpat, this is, Noach lacked that. Says the Ketush Levi, because he lacked the confidence, he didn't daven for anybody else. Who am I to daven? Who am I to argue with what seems to be Ratzon Hashem? Exactly what Rav Kook's saying, it's exactly what Rav Tzadok HaKohen is saying. Even if we're not Noach and Hashem hasn't revealed his plans to us and no one should feel the weight of the whole world on your shoulders, it's okay. But at least your own life, your own world, that is on your shoulders. And you should feel confident. And last but not least, you know why? You're not just a chelik al-kamimah, you're not just a human being made in Hashem image. You're not just a banim la-makom, you're not just a member of the Am HaNivchar. You're a Jewish mother. And I've said this many times, and I said it when people have asked me, you know, where's the big koach in the davening? I said, the single most important person to daven is the person in need himself, the chola himself. Don't go to rebbes, this is in Makoros. The most important to daven is the person himself or herself. But you want to know what's the second most important, what's the second biggest skula? Your mother. I'm not joking, and I've said this to people in real life events. A Jewish mother There's unbelievable potential. So the Medrash in Eicha speaks about it for Tisha B'Av, right? How when the Churban is about to happen, right? Navi went to all the different Avos, to Moshe, to Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, and they're all trying to give arguments. This is in the Psichta and Eicha Rabbah, to Hashem that he shouldn't do it, he shouldn't destroy it. And then who comes out? Rachel Imenu. It's the way the Medrash describes her. Miyad, after she gives her tefillah, she talks about what she was willing to give up. She wasn't jealous over her sister. So Hashem, you shouldn't be jealous that the Jewish people are running around with idols. Says the Medrash, Miyad nisgalgulu rachamav shal kodesh baruch hu. Bomer b'shvileich, Rachel. Ani machzir es Yisrael v'mkomon. The koach of a Jewish mother. I remember, not in this conversation, but on a tape, I heard also an amazing story from Solomon. Before he came to Lakewood, he was in Gateshead. So it was a bachur in that yeshiva, he said, it was an average bachur. And every single zman, he used to get like the best chavrusa. So again, it was an elul zman. And again, the boy has the best chavrusa. Couldn't understand it. So until one night, he's walking back to his office after Mariv, and he sees that the boy's online he's at the payphone. Used to be a thing called payphones, you remember? The boy's online with the payphone. He didn't need an asimon, he was in England. And he's waiting, and as Rav Solomon is back in his office, he hears the boy calling up, and he says, Mommy, you can stop davening. I found my chavrusa. Could you imagine? The power that you have, a Jewish mother, a grandmother, amazing, amazing. So let me conclude with one final story. Again, just to review, we've spoken about how challenging davening is, how challenging kavana is. We spoke about a number of the specific issues that we have. We don't prepare, but if we do, that would help. By rote, habit, we gave a few different practical suggestions of how to make things new, how to shake things up, to bring a little freshness to our davening. We spoke about some of the machshava issues that somehow compromise our davening. We don't necessarily... Sometimes we give up if we think we haven't been successful. We don't always believe in our davening, in the koach of davening. We don't really, in our heart of hearts, we don't really believe it can help. And that will affect the whole davening. And we don't always believe in ourselves and our own worthiness to be answered. And we have had and we will have moments of inspiration. So how do we deal with the dips? So I'll end with the following true story. When the Mir Yeshiva was in Shanghai after they had ran around, you imagine these were little boys. They didn't really know what was going on, and it was very hectic and crazy. But when they had that first Yom Kippur in Shanghai, around that time, after they had been running already for a while, it finally dawned on these boys just how bad things were back in Europe. Just what probably would really be happening to the family that they left behind. They had their Mashkiach, the Heder B'Cheskel Levenstein, and that, with his leadership, that Yom Kippur, the davening was beyond anything. Nothing in the mirror had ever touched what happened at Yom Kippur in Shanghai. The davening was incredible. They were just transported to another places. They were davening mamish for the life of their parents, of their siblings. And when they finished Ne'ilah, they finished Mariv, some of the boys, they were so excited and such a high, they said to them they wanted to do something for the Mashkiach, to thank him for his leadership. So apparently, even in the mirror, he had such a long Shemon Esrei that it was an accepted minug, that they didn't wait for him, certainly not at the end of a fast. And people would go break the fast while he was still davening Shemon Esrei. And that was accepted. So that Yom Kippur, they said they're going to make an exception. And after Mariv, instead of running to the dining room to break the fast, after a sweltering, non-air-conditioned Shanghai Yom Kippur, they're all going to sit and have a learning Seder until he finishes Shemon Esrei. 15, 20 minutes later, he takes his 3 steps back and he turns around and he's shocked. A Beis Medrash for Labachar. He's moved to tears. And he tells them the following mashal. He says, there was once a really rich man who built the biggest house in town. But he wasn't just trying to show off or being selfish. On the contrary, when he was almost done, he invited the whole town to the Chanukah Sabayis. And there was going to be a band and a party and a kiddush. And when everyone was assembled, he got up on the ladder to go to the top of the chimney. He's going to put in the last brick. When all of a sudden, a big gust of wind came and blew him down. And he flew a few stories. Thud! On the ground. It's a big palpable from the crowd. People ran over to try to get him. And a few minutes later, when he finally came to, he looked up, said, my house has fallen down. So they waited another minute or two. Obviously, he was still a bit confused. They said, no, Shlomi, don't worry. The house is fine. You fell down, but the house is just fine. said Rabbi Yechezkel Levinstein, what you did today, you built a mansion. You did something incredible. And I know, he says, what all of you are thinking. In a day, in a week, in a month, it's not going to be the same. And I can't daven like this every day. And you're already thinking, I'm going to fall, so what was even the point? Was it really worth it? He says, let me tell you something, gentlemen. You built a mansion today. And even when you will fall, and you will because we're all human, never be confused like that man. Don't make the mistake. You may fall, but the house is never going to fall. What you built today will be with you forever. And the rest of your life, whenever you need it, you can look back and draw chizuk from the davening that we just had today. You may fall, but that never will. And that, I think, perhaps is the most important chizuk we can give ourselves. Whether it's the weekend, the shir, or other things, hopefully you'll have hisoris, you'll daven well. Rosh Hashanah, Yom Kippur is coming up, this shul, other shuls, you'll have great bali tefillah, they'll be singing, it'll be amazing. You can have amazing davening. And Sukkot is going to be then, and it'll be amazing. And then it'll be a long, long winter this year. And already you're thinking, what's going to be? Had to really keep it up, it was nice. I went to a shir, I went to another sicha, I had a good davening. I can be frustrated like all of us. But don't let it get you down. When you have these beautiful davenings, especially this time of year, that will stay with you. Even if you fall, and we're all human, you can always go back. And once you've seen you can do it, you can do it again. It can be repeated. And that should give you chizuk. The fact that you're trying, the fact that you care, the fact that you do it. We all need your tefillos. We need them. Not just your own families. We all need your tefillos. And you can do it. And my bracha is that we should always be able to do it. B'tavach and Hashanah Tova to everyone. Thank you.